the Church of God the Eternal presents the second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 27th, 2023.
Now, it's already been more than a month since the last time I spoke to you here and started a new series of sermons, which I've entitled Habitat for God and Man. So we're going to get back to the second message in that series. The intent of this series really is to give you a perspective. I mean, nothing new. Well, there may be a number of new things. I hope that there will be some new angles or perspectives on old material that will give you a sense of appreciation and maybe depth to make some of these principles more three-dimensional rather than two-dimensional. That's my hope. So last time we began to examine what the Bible tells us about dwelling places. And there's a lot in the Bible about dwelling places. I'm using the word habitat, which is pretty much a synonym, by the way, that I'm using it. So we are talking about habitats. What does God show to us is significant about the physical and the spiritual aspects of these dwelling places or habitats, both for God and for man? And what can we glean from it? So I began last time, and I'll repeat this just because it's been a while, the dictionary definition of the word habitat. Remember, I told you that, and there's basically four different aspects here. The first one, a definition of habitat, is a place or an environment where a plant or an animal naturally or normally lives and grows. So as it applies to the flora and the fauna, and then we think about that a lot of times when you use it in scientific term, a habitat for animals and plants. But it also, the word habitat means technically a typical place of residence of a person or a group. So yes, it is appropriately used for human beings as well, even though we don't necessarily talk about living or having a habitat, but we do. It's just, and in essence, I'm using it as a dwelling place, a place where you exist in one way or another, and to the extent that you live and you thrive, if you do, is dependent upon all of the attributes of your habitat. We're going to get into that as we get further along in this series. But another clinical definition is a housing for a controlled physical environment in which people can live under surrounding inhospitable conditions. So there, now we're talking about an artificial habitat. And we're going to have a lot to say about that. Meaning, where you've got a creature, whether it's plant, animal, or human being, that's existing outside of its normal habitat. And what are all the things that are required in order to keep it alive and thriving to some extent? So an artificial habitat, that's one element of it. And so the dictionary I used an example of under the sea. So if you get in a submarine and go down 100 meters, you are living as a human being in an artificial habitat. That you're not really able to live there in a normal state, but you can take your habitat with you. But it is certainly very artificial, and we're going to talk a lot about that. And then the last one, definition, is a place where something is commonly found. So habitat can be used in a very general way, just to say wherever you find something in nature or where it normally is. Okay, that's your natural habitat is someplace. All right, so last time we saw that God's habitat, there's a lot that the Bible says about where God dwells, where God lives. In essence, where is the habitat of God? And because he is an immortal being that does not depend upon any environmental effects in order to exist or to thrive, then God lives wherever he wants. And because of the attributes of God, as we know him, then in essence, one of the attributes of God? He's omnipresent, right? Which means God is everywhere. Not like the pantheists believe, these pagan religions that think that God is in everything. No, but God is everywhere he wants to be. And he wants to be everywhere, and in essence, he permeates with his presence through the power of his spirit. So where does God live? Everywhere, anywhere. But we looked at some of the texts in the Bible. I'm not going to repeat those that show what he chose to describe about himself. In essence, one of them says that God's habitat is eternity. Literally dwells in eternity. We also saw that his is a holy habitat, because wherever God is holy. Symbolically, we saw that God sits on the circle of the earth. Also that his habitat is defined as justice and judgment. Where does God live? In the midst of justice and judgment. We also saw that heaven is his throne and the earth is his footstool. Not literally, but that's how he chose to describe his relationship, especially with human beings and the earth as it exists, to try to give us the impression in our weak, limited human minds to understand how big God is, how powerful and all-consuming that he is, to say heaven is his throne and the earth is his footstep. We also saw that heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain him. We also examine then the description of King David and his son Solomon and David's inspiration to want to build a house for God, if you remember. And God inspired through the prophet Nathan to say, yeah, go ahead and tell David he's on the right path. But then said, but don't get the wrong impression, because you're not really building me a house. He says, in fact, I'm going to turn that on its head. And what's really happening here is I'm building you a house. So now there he's referring to the opportunity to actually offer salvation to the human family, which was going to be given through a descendant of David who would be none other than Jesus Christ. And so David, thinking in his limited fashion about showing honor to God and building a house where God can live, and God says that's not really what's happening here. But he commissioned it. But it was his son Solomon who God inspired to be able to literally bring that building into existence that became the temple that we call Solomon's temple. Destroyed, rebuilt again, and destroyed again. So all of those aspects of habitats, of buildings, of houses, of dwelling places have incredible significance for the people of God, and we're going to look at a number of those. But in short, we learn that God needs no special place to dwell. He needs no habitat. He has no constraints that require any living restrictions in order for him to live or to thrive. There is no limit upon him in any way. And this point is important in order for us to compare God to every other creature now that we're going to begin to talk about. So we started with the description of God and his habitat, just because it's going to make the point. Now, I really am not intending to spend time on angels, but then I decided after the fact I am going to spend a few minutes and talk about the angels. So I didn't really put this in my notes. But here is another class of beings that are not God. So what do we say about the habitat for angels? Well, what do they have in common with God? God created them to be immortal beings, right? They are immortal, which means they have self-existent life. They don't die. All right, that's the way God made them. But as most and many human beings on this earth have been deceived to think and to equate angels with God, even as many of them, most of them think that Satan, if you believe in Satan, they believe that he's equal in power to God and that God is in this tug of war with Satan for the souls of men. That's a total fabrication and a lie. The angels, whether faithful angels or fallen angels, are servants to God, and they are under his authority. They cannot do whatever they want. They are constrained absolutely by their maker. So they are immortal beings, which makes them different than human beings, which means they too do not need a habitat like human beings or plants and animals do on this earth in order to live. They don't need to eat. They don't need to breathe. So they are immortal beings. They have that self-existent life. However, they are not God. The attributes of God, what was the one that we learned? God is all-powerful, omnipotent. He is also has all knowledge. That's, we call that omniscience. And then ever-present that we've already talked about. So angels are not all-powerful. Angels are powerful beings only to the extent that God, their creator, and their boss has given them, delegated them a certain amount of power. So we think of angels as having power, but not God power, only a small smidgen of God's power. Whether faithful agent, angel, or fallen angel. Limited power, so not God power. What about knowledge? Angels have lots of knowledge, but they don't have all knowledge, past, present, and future. They are not omniscient. They have the knowledge that God gave to them in part. They are limited. And what about their ability to be in places? They are not ever present as God is. They are not omnipresent at all. And I don't know that I've ever emphasized that or heard it emphasized. But if they are not God, it means they do not have the attributes which are uniquely God. Omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. Angels are not. So that just makes the point then when you think about where the angels dwell. Are they like God where they're everywhere? No, they're not. Everything that we know and understand, and by everything that I know that I grew up with in God's church, their omnipresence is an attribute of God, which means angels don't have it, which means angels can only be in one place at a time. Even if God gives them the power to zip from one to another in the universe, even within a fraction of a second, they still have to move from one place to another. They are not like God that can be everywhere at once, in case that's something new to you. But that's just an outgrowth of the knowledge we've already had, even if it's never been said out loud. All right, so then what would we say about the habitat of angels? They live where God assigns them to live. But again, they don't need physical support in order to live. They have self-existent life by God's determination. All right, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. The only thing I'll make reference to 1 Corinthians 15:40. We will use that and look at that text next time. But this is basically where Paul was inspired. Remember, 1 Corinthians 15 is the resurrection chapter. And the Apostle Paul was inspired to talk about this whole master plan and the way that God is offering salvation to humanity. But then Paul in verse 40 describes this difference between the celestial and the terrestrial. So there's not only, he says in verse 39, I think it was, that there's a difference between flesh. So when we're talking about physical creatures, there's a difference between the fish and the animals and the birds and humanity as God made it. But then there's also, but the thing they all have in common is they're terrestrial. They're physical. But there's a separate classification of beings which are not terrestrial. They are celestial. Now we're talking about beings that do not exist in the physical plane. They have spirit bodies. And that includes both angels and God. So just to give those distinctions. All right. So what I want to get to, however, now is we're going to start talking about the terrestrial. We've described God in an overview of his habitat, which is anywhere he wants to be. And he needs nothing to support his life. There's nothing that God needs from the outside in order to exist and to thrive. What about terrestrial beings? All right, now we're going to start looking at some examples of physical creatures that God made. All right, let's go to Genesis 1, verse 20. Genesis 1 and verse 20, here we read, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. So here on one of the days of creation, we're two aspects of his creation, both the fish and the birds. Verse 21, and God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. So here's described both fish and fowl. Verse 22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let fowl multiply in the earth. All right, we're going to talk about the fish. And what I want to do is describe for you. Now, we take for granted the fact that God made these things and he created a habitat for them, didn't he? So he created in this terrestrial environment on this earth, on this planet, a habitat that allows these creatures not only to exist, but to thrive. And so when things are kept as God intended them, these creatures do exist and they thrive and they reproduce. I know this is basic stuff, like duh, but I want you to put this in context of the big picture. So now we're going to talk about fish in particular. It's easy to take for granted the fish in the sea or in the lakes or in the rivers. And they do what they do by nature, and nobody manages them, right? As long as man doesn't corrupt their habitat, then they work very well independently. They have everything that they need. All right, but if you take a fish out of its natural habitat in the wild, in other words, you now are going to create an artificial habitat for a fish, like a pet. We're going to talk about what it takes in order to have a pet goldfish. To make the point of what it takes. Now, however they exist without your intervention or your care or feeding or attention in the wild, God taking care of them, but now you're going to take them out of that natural environment. How are you going to keep them alive? By this, we're going to learn a little bit about what is actually involved in the physical habitat of a goldfish. So I went to a source just to try and find a simple, condensed place to tell me, is I don't want pages and pages of a description of how to take care of a goldfish. And I found one at a website. Actually, I found this at WebMD. Like, I thought that was about human health. So I don't know why they also had this article on how to care for a goldfish, but I'm going to read you some of it. Goldfish habitat. If you're going to take a fish and keep it alive yourself and care for it in an artificial habitat, this is what you gotta do. It says here, goldfish can grow to be quite big, with some reaching 12 inches in length. Because of their potential size, be careful to provide your goldfish with adequate space. An aquarium for one goldfish should be around 25 to 30 gallons. This is for the Americans who use the imperial measures. We also find most fish, it says, require plants in their aquarium. Did you know that? Some of you probably who care for fish have kept, you know this. I've never had fish. I don't know anything about this. So this is a good summary for me. Most fish require plants in their aquariums. Goldfish are no different. Some common types of plants to include in a goldfish habitat include African water fern, anacharis, dwarf anubias, frog bit, hornwort, java fern, java moss, parrot feather, water sprite. I don't even know what those are. Going on, it says, when choosing what aquatic plants to include in your goldfish aquarium, you'll want to consider the aquarium's temperature and lighting. So there's two more things you got to worry about. Temperature and lighting. Both the plants and the goldfish need to be able to thrive at the same temperature. Common sense, right? But how many of us would not take that in consideration? Since goldfish do well in temperatures around 70 degrees Fahrenheit, what is that, about 21 Celsius? Choose aquatic plants that also can live in 70 degree Fahrenheit water. Then it says, besides plants, you want to add plenty of substrates, which I think means like gravel, something in the bottom of the tank. Decorations and shelter options. So little fish like to have things to hide behind and under, if you want them to thrive, I guess. You can also add equipment, so if you want to spend more money on it, you can add equipment such as heaters, UV sterilizers, lights, filters, and automatic feeders. Okay, what about goldfish diet? Goldfish are opportunistic feeders and will eat as much food as you give them. You mustn't overfeed them, as this can lead to complications such as constipation, which can have deadly consequences. You do not want a constipated fish, so I'm told. It says symptoms of an overfed goldfish include lethargy and a bloated abdomen. If you notice these symptoms, you'll want to cut back on how much you feed your goldfish. Goldfish will eat whatever they encounter in the wild, including algae, aquatic plants, insects, and tadpoles. They'll even eat other fish. Did you know that? Pet goldfish, it says, can be fed a variety of items too, including fish pellets, fish flakes, freeze-dried and frozen foods such as brine shrimp and water fleas, vegetables and fruits, I did not know that, and live foods such as certain types of worms and aquarium snails. Never, it says, feed your goldfish bread, fish food blocks, or mammalian proteins. So, did you learn something from that? In summary, a proper goldfish habitat, if you're going to take a fish out of its natural God-given habitat in the wild, and now you're going to create an artificial habitat with everything that it needs according to God's creation in order to keep it alive and to make it thrive, proper goldfish habitat includes an aquarium or a pond of sufficient size, proper plants, proper lighting, proper water temperature, shelters, filters, cleaners, proper food, and proportion of feeding. That's a lot, isn't it? So it's not as simple as we might assume. All right, so that's one fish out of all of those that God created and filled the rivers and the lakes and the seas. What about a habitat for a land animal? Go back with me to Genesis 1 again, and now let's read verse 24 and 25. Genesis 1, verse 24 says, "And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle," meaning livestock, "and creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, the cattle after their kind, every thing that creeps upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good." So in fact, this was all made on the same day, the sixth day, as man was made. All right, so God set it in motion. He created all of these land animals. And again, he created for each of them a dwelling place or a habitat to allow them to live and to thrive. So if we're going to just pick one of those land animals and examine its habitat for comparison, let's pick the horse. Now, we have some in the church who have owned or do own horses, and I would consider even some horse experts. They know about this. I do not, except from afar. So again, I went to a source, at least to try and find something that was short and summarize. In essence, if you're going to get into the horse business or you want a pet horse, what are the things you have to take into consideration if you're going to create an artificial habitat out of the wild? Now, we all know about wild horses, right? Less of them on the earth than there used to be, but, you know, we know about these herds of wild horses, and they take care of themselves, right? As long as they can roam and they can go and they have what they need and they don't need man's intervention, because God gave them the means, including their own instinct, to know how to get what they need from the natural wild environment. So without man's intervention, wild horses live and thrive. What are the elements, however, that are a part of that habitat as God created it to sustain horses? You're going to take a horse out of the wild environment, and now you're going to have a domesticated horse, and you're going to provide an artificial habitat. What are you going to do? What are the elements that they need? Okay, this was from a source called thesprucepets.com. I was looking for a succinct bullet point type of a list. This is the shortest one I could find. At the very least, a horse needs pasture free from hazards such as holes, rusty farm machinery, and loose wire fences. Seems like common sense, but you need to think about that. If you were going to have a pet horse, do you have a place for it? A pasture free from hazards. Secondly, you need safe fencing, such as wooden, plastic, or vinyl rails, or mesh wire fencing. Proper fencing, number one, that's going to keep the horse in and also not going to hurt the horse. Next, you need grass for grazing, or the equivalent amount of good quality hay. Next, you need unlimited supply of fresh, clean water. Heated, if necessary, in sub-freezing temperatures. So horses can exist in extreme climates, but one of the things they need is clean water at all times. So if the water's frozen, that's a problem. What else do horses need? They need access to salt. And even if you're not a country person or dealt with animals, you understand the use of a salt lick, for example, to put out. I remember this when I was a child and my family had a 65-acre farm in Tennessee before we moved to Southern California, and Dad had cattle. And I remember, you know, him having a block of salt out there that the cows would lick. As a small child, 3-4 years old, I remember that. So it's true for horses. They need a source of salt. It's one of the things God created. Now, I didn't go to see, well, in the wild, how do horses get salt? I'm sure there is a means. I didn't get that deep into it. But they need access to salt. What else do horses need? They need shelter from wet or wintry weather, and they need shade in summer. So they do need shelter. Shelter from wet or wintry weather, and they need shade in summer. I guess in the wild, they find that themselves. If you have a domesticated horse, you're going to have to provide it. They also need a dry, clean area to lie down. I think about horses sleeping standing up, but they lie down. And so they need a dry, clean area in order to lie down. They also need daily monitoring for injury or illness. That becomes your responsibility. They also need, this is listed as an important element for the health and care of a domesticated horse, they need companionship. Did you know that? Horses need companionship either with another horse, a donkey, a mule, a pony, or another animal such as a sheep or a goat, a comfort goat. So that has to do, so is there a mental element for horses? And this source says yes, they actually need a companion, and it makes a difference in their welfare. Horses also need regular grooming. Now, they don't get that in the wild, I guess, unless they groom each other. But if you have a domesticated horse, they need to be groomed, including their coat, their hooves, etc. You have to take care of that and provide that. And lastly, you have to care for your stable, the shelter where they live. And guess what? Because those stalls have to be cleaned. So, unlike the wild horses that roam around and they can, you know, drop their residue wherever they want and move on. Not so in a confined space, so you're going to have to keep it clean. And they will not thrive if you do not keep them in a clean environment. Okay, so again, just to give you a hint, I'm not a horse person, but I thought, okay, what are some of these elements that are true because they're verified in the physical environment and human beings can prove it? Well, these are elements that can be proven. The difference in a horse that actually does thrive versus one that gets sick and dies or wastes away. So God made these things and they're all true. So in summary, a horse needs space that is secured, free of dangers. Horse needs food, water, salt, exercise, clean shelter, including dry bedding, temperature-controlled environment, grooming, and companionship. That's a lot, isn't it? In the wild, God provides that. But if you're going to take an animal out of the wild and create an artificial habitat, these are all the elements you have to include and to keep in mind for it to be successful. Okay, so we've talked about fish in the sea, and we've talked about one of the many land animals that God made. Let's go back to Genesis 1 and read verses 11 through 12. We've talked in essence about the fauna, meaning physical creatures. But here was another element of God's creation. Verse 11, God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed after his kind, and tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. So now we're talking about plants. So not the animal kingdom, but now we're talking about the plant kingdom, called by the scientists the flora. All right, I went back to this same website, thespruce.com, and I want to describe for you now the care and feeding for orchids. Now, it's my understanding that orchids are harder to grow and to keep alive than are other kinds of plants, and some of us do not have green thumbs. We have, in essence, black thumbs, the tendency to kill things rather than help them to thrive. But if you decided that you wanted to grow orchids in particular, what would be required in order to successfully grow orchids and have them bloom and to keep them alive for the future? All right, so from this website, here are the elements in the habitat. So, of course, orchids grow in the wild. I looked it up and it said that there's over 20,000 kinds of orchids. And they actually grow in a lot of different habitats, including North America, although they're not as common. Because mostly they are tropical or subtropical plants. All right, but there's so many variations, it's not all one size fits all. But how did God create the habitat requirements for, in particular, this? Now, that's the other thing. Is an orchid a flower or is it a plant? Well, everything I read says they're not flowers. They are flowering plants. I don't know. Isn't that true for all flowers? Aren't all flowers actually plants that flower? I don't know. I didn't take the time to look it up. But the ones who are like into orchids are like really serious about this. They're not flowers. They're plants that flower. Okay, got it. All right, so what are the requirements if you're going to grow orchids and do it well? Number one is soil. Orchid potting mix, it says, with combinations of mosses, shredded bark, dried shredded leaves, sand, small rocks, and perlite. Some orchids prefer to grow in moist sphagnum moss. I don't know what that is. The main principle is to keep the mixture loose and light. You want the roots well hydrated, but not soggy, with room to breathe and take up nutrients. It seems like these are finicky plants to me. What else do they need besides exactly the right soil? They need light. What kind of light do they need? It says almost all orchids need indirect light in varying amounts. Some require less light and more shade. Others prefer dappled light through a window blind or shade cloth. Still others need bright light to thrive and to bloom. The important concept to remember is that light should be indirect, which in the case of natural light means the sun does not shine directly onto the plant. Full darkness at night, as well as a drop in temperature, encourages bloom. A good starting location is near a southeast-facing window in a room that does not use fluorescent light at night. So the light seems to be a big deal. So all I can assume is in the wild, the way God made them, without human intervention or management, is that orchids actually grow where they find these right conditions. I also read, by the way, that a lot of orchids grow on other plants, including trees. They don't gain their nutrients from the tree, but they actually attach themselves to tree bark and whatever, or to rocks, let alone just being in soil. So a very fascinating kind of plant. But light seems to be important. They don't take direct, most of them do not take direct sunlight. I guess that'll kill them. So they need light, but it's got to be indirect light. Okay, what else? The best temperature. What about, are they temperature sensitive? Oh, yes. The best temperatures are often a little higher than average household temperatures during the day and a little cooler at night. Again, finicky plants, I would say. Getting at least close to ideal temperatures is important, but even more important is avoiding wide fluctuations, and you can make subtle adjustments that encourage the orchid to adapt. What else? Humidity. I wouldn't have thought of that. This says humidity is important to an orchid. Humidity levels are key to orchid health and encouraging blooms. Many are tropical plants that grow naturally in steamy, moisture-laden environments. Lowering humidity is rarely an issue, and there are several ways to raise it. Place the pot on a tray of pebbles with water. Keep the bottom of the pot above water level and periodically rinse and sterilize the tray and pebbles. Place one or more ferns around your orchid. Fronds release water, which can increase humidity. Purchase a mister and use a spray bottle to add moisture to the air around your orchid. Avoid direct mist onto the plant itself. Misting is best done in the morning, which allows any water drops that might accumulate to dry before nightfall. Man, really? So in the wild, God took care of this. And the ones who don't have all of these things wither and die or never grow to begin with. But when all those things exist in the right proportions in the habitat that God made for them, then all those things are present and this plant grows and flourishes. But again, if you or I are going to try to do this, duplicate, in essence, we're trying to duplicate the habitat that God made and provide enough of these elements so that we can also get that same living creature, in this case an orchid, to thrive. What else does it need? There's two more things on this list. Fertilizer. Now, how does it get fertilized in the wild? I guess other matter. I don't know. But anyway, this says fertilizer. Orchids need supplemental feeding because it's not grown in soil that readily available nutrients. Again, it's artificial. So you're going to have to supplement the soil. It says some orchid bark mixes contain fertilizer, so check your potting mixes bag before adding more fertilizer. Roots are sensitive to salts in many commercial fertilizers, so choose one formulated specifically for orchids. Even then, a diluted application of 1/2 to 1/4 strength is often recommended. A good starting point is to fertilize your orchid once a month. When you see new growth like a leaf, root, or bud forming, increase applications to once every 2 weeks. A lot of attention and paying attention. Okay, so fertilizer. You're going to have to fertilize your orchid. What else? Orchids need rest. I did not know that. Here it says, once the gorgeous flowers fade and drop, it's a common mistake to think these unique and highly collectible plants are done. Cut the flower spike back and give the orchid a rest. It takes a huge amount of energy to support a bloom period of up to 3 months. So don't worry if your plant appears to do nothing for a few months. Keep up a consistent maintenance schedule, and soon enough it will produce a new node for a leaf, root, or pseudo bulb. Then it's just a matter of time until it blooms again. So what you get, if you do it right and you create a perfect habitat, you get blooms for 3 months, and then it goes to sleep, and it needs to rest for several months, and you still got to tend that plant if you want it ultimately to flower again. So you work on it all the time, but you see the blooms on it for a short number of months out of the year. If you create an artificial habitat for this particular creation of God. Turn with me to Job 12, verse 7. Job 12, beginning in verse 7, "But ask not the beasts, I ask now the beast, and they shall teach you, and the fowls of the air, and they shall tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it shall teach you, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto you." What? Because they're talking? No. Meaning man can derive valuable information about the functioning of all these elements of God's creation by observing nature, which is exactly what's being described here poetically. "Speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee." Verse 9, "Who knows not in all these that the hand of the Eternal hath wrought this?" You see, it is a complex creation. We can easily take it for granted, especially when it just happens on autopilot from our perspective. But how intricate is the creation of God upon this earth, this terrestrial ball, and the habitats that support all of these terrestrial beings, including plants and animals, and by the way, human beings. That's what we have in common with these other creatures. We are terrestrial. Unlike the angels, who are celestial like God, we are terrestrial, like the plants and the animals, for the time being. "Who knows not in all these that the hand of the Eternal hath wrought this?" Verse 10, "In whose hand is the soul of every living thing and the breath of all mankind?" The breath of all mankind. So then there is man included by the inspiration of God through Job in this description now of these terrestrial beings. Now it's interesting that, you know, I guess they have some accreditation for plants breathe in a certain way. We're certainly aware that land animals breathe. We certainly know that we need to breathe. And it's also true that fish breathe through gills and whatever. So they take their oxygen or whatever out of the water, and they can't live out of the water. You and I can't breathe in the water. And yet we're all have that in common, the support of terrestrial life by the need in order to feed and to keep those processes as God created them going. So there's a description as an overview. That gives you a limited idea about habitats for other creatures. Obviously, the ones we want to get to is human beings. Because the title of this series is about the habitat of God and man. Now, the other thing that you already know is that man was created in the image of God. So you and I are created temporarily as terrestrial creatures like the plants and the animals, and yet our hope and our expectation and our purpose for existence is not to stay that way. Whereas the angels were created immortal, and there's no change for them. They're in their permanent state as God made them. And according to their choices, either to serve the family of God or else to be set aside in outer darkness forever. But their makeup is fixed. The makeup of fish, the makeup of animals, the makeup of plants is fixed. So what we're going to find is that with human beings, of course, then we were created in one state, but with the potential and the expectation and the opportunity to be transformed, to be added to the God family. So you have a habitat right now which God has given to you upon this planet. And by the way, in nature, you can't live off this planet. By nature, you have to have the elements that God put here just as much as these other creatures we've described. And eliminate one of those key elements of your habitat and you will not thrive, if not die. But all of the elements of human habitat, all of the elements of human habitat have a spiritual counterpart. So what I'm setting up for, and I don't want to go any further on this to get into that, because I am at a good stopping point. Next time, we're going to begin to examine the specific elements of habitat that God made for man. They're all things you and I take for granted. But we're going to look at each physical necessity and their spiritual counterparts, because there is type and antitype to every single one of them. We'll get into that next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the second message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 27th, 2023.